webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good morning. Welcome to The Dividing Line. I'd like to take you back to sometime in 2008. I'm not sure actually when this aired, come to think of it. I think this is a 2007 program, if I recall correctly. But in 2008, I played for you a portion of an interview that took place between the infidel guy and Bart Ehrman. And it was a fascinating interview because Ehrman ended up having to lecture this fellow on the existence of Jesus. And it was interesting. Basically, all Ehrman could provide him was sort of a "I'm a historian, believe me" type defense. But at one point during the discussion, and you could tell the infidel guy didn't like the fact that Ehrman was basically doing the, "Hey, I'm a historian, I've done this for 30 years, believe me" type thing. And the discussion going back and forth had something to do with the existence of Jesus. And Ehrman basically said, "Well, look, you know, Paul met with Jesus' relatives." "Well, how do you know that?" "Well, he says in Galatians." "Well, how do you know he wrote Galatians?" "Well, everybody knows he wrote Galatians." And, you know, I found it interesting because it was putting the shoe on the other foot, in essence. And I found that interesting and rather provocative along those lines. But anyway, finally, the infidel guy asks the question, "What do you think about Robert Price?" Now, most of you are aware of the fact that coming up in May at the CRI National Conference, I will be debating Robert Price on the subject of the truthfulness of the Bible. And it is interesting to listen to Ehrman's dismissing of Price in this clip, because you can tell this is where the infidel guy has been getting a lot of his material. And so I want to play this and listen as the infidel guy clearly does not like what is going on here, and listen as Ehrman and he discuss the infidel guy.
Right. What do you think about Dr. Bob Price? Dr. Bob Price is
right. No.
You don't know Dr. Robert M. Price?
He's the guy who denied Jesus existed.
I think he's pretty much leaning more toward that, yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think he, I mean, he's not, I don't really know him, no.
Interesting.
Why would I?
Oh, man, well, I mean, he's a theologian as well. And
what books has he published?
You can look him up. He has too many to mention right now. Deconstructing Jesus. Have you heard that one? And
Incredible Shrinking Son of
Yeah, God. He's actually communicated with me, and he's Lossal told me Lossal. Some of his That's doubts, right. And I've been puzzled by it because I don't really understand. I haven't seen any evidence that he's adduced.
Okay. Well, there you go. Well, I would suggest maybe you want to read some of his stuff. But again, I know you're so busy. You probably read. It's just like me. I have 100 books on the shelf. I think I still haven't gotten a chance to read yet because I get books every week. But. Okay, but yeah, I mean, he's quite an, people are posting them all in a room, the Colossal Apostle, the Shrinking Son of Man, but as you know.
Oh, that guy. Yeah, Shrinking Son of Man. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay. That guy. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
there are some people who've been researching even longer than you have, and they also have, you know, doctors, double doctors. They've been researching this. Some, I think he's even a professor at a university.
No, he's not.
He was teaching at, where was he?
He doesn't have a teaching job.
I can't remember where he was. Well, he did or does. I can't remember now.
No, he doesn't.
I don't keep up with him right now, but he was at some place instructing on. I can't remember now, but too bad he's not here. Maybe one of the fans will call him up and he can give us a call in here. But anyway, my point was though. I guess for me, I like to consider myself a pretty rational guy, and I try to stay away from absolutes as much as possible. Whenever someone says, nobody, this can't be, or this is impossible, or things like that.
No, what I said is, thousands of New Testament scholars I know, nobody doubts that Paul wrote Galatians. That's what I said. And that's not an absolute statement. I mean,
okay, I'm sorry. I guess I misunderstood you. Earlier, it sounded like you didn't. It sounded like you kind of qualified it just now. But before, it just sounded like you said anybody. You just said nobody thinks this. Nobody thinks that.
Nobody of the thousands of scholars I know doubts it.
Right. Right. Okay. None of the ones you know. Granted.
And I know all the leading figures in the field.
Right.
I mean, I'm very active in the Society of Biblical Literature.
Right.
And, I know all the professors in the major universities in the country who teach this.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, all right. There's also Hector Avalos. Somebody brings him up
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, he's a colleague of mine.
Right. And,
Okay, so there you have basically the dismissal of Bob Price by Bert Ehrman. Who's that? What books did he write? He doesn't teach anywhere. Well, actually, he has. He at the Johnny Coleman Theological Seminary, which I've never heard of before, but that's where he has taught. And of course, if you're an atheist, I'm not sure what you're doing teaching at a theological seminary, which may be why I've never heard of that seminary. But it doesn't matter to me. Listening to that, I'm like, well, okay, you know, here's someone who's basically dismissed. So why am I debating him? Well, as I have been listening to Bob Price, I have discovered that, things are a little bit different than I expected. Bob Price does not mind being in the minority. And he openly admits that his views are not the majority of scholarship, that he's in a small minority, and sometimes he holds a unique position. And then basically says, so what? Now, since most of us listening to this webcast also hold minority positions on a lot of things, you can at least respect that and recognize there are times you need to go, you know, just because the majority of people say they believe something doesn't mean the majority of people have ever given any thought whatsoever to why they believe it. They've just been told that, and they've accepted that, and that's just all there is to it. Whenever I hear Bart Ehrman saying, well, the majority of scholars don't believe in the tenacity theory anymore, how many of them have actually ever addressed the issue in any in-depth way whatsoever? Or how many are just following the flow? Be very, very careful of majority arguments along those lines. Sometimes they're relevant. Most of the time, they're not. And so what I want to do today is I want to introduce you to Bob Price, and partly to just ask for you to pray for the upcoming debate. I'm investing as much time as I possibly can in preparation for it. I've listened to what I'm going to be playing for you multiple times already. I'm going to have to invest a lot of time between now and May, pretty much all of next month, tracking down sources. And it's such a wide topic that it's going to be extremely difficult and probably frustrating to cram it into about 2.5 hours worth of time. But I think it's going to be one of the better debates we've had, because this is a lively fellow. And he's willing to pretty much go after any question around. He's not going to be dodging and ducking and so on and so forth. But he's going to say some pretty wild things. Now, I have noticed, as is common, that he says one set of things when he's talking to, when he's in the minority amongst believers. And then when he's being interviewed by atheists, he goes a little bit farther. And I will play for you, I think, what will end up being, I'm actually going to make a prediction right now, what will end up being one of the most important statements introduced into evidence in the debate in May. I won't play that today, but I can tell you that it was in a Australian interview that he did with an atheist in Australia, where Dr. Price basically said that even if the disciples had written the gospel immediately after the life of Jesus, it wouldn't make any difference. Now, you see, he doesn't believe that any of the Gospels, the Gospels are primarily second century. He doesn't believe Paul wrote anything attributed to him. He doesn't really believe Jesus existed. He is a Pyrrhonist. That is, he is the absolute skeptic. We can't know anything. In fact, he remains that way very consistently. We can't even know what's going on right now. You can have, Hollywood can do green screening and, can do all sorts of stuff. We really can't know anything that's going on. We can't do history. And, of course, that's going to be one of the issues I'm going to be raising, is if your entire system destroys any historiography, you can't know what's happening in history. There's one thing that we absolutely for certain know. History took place. Something happened in history. And if you're in a situation where you cannot understand that, cannot come to know that, then your destructive skepticism has taken you too far. And that's the situation with Bob Price. But I want you to hear Bob Price. I want you to hear what he has to say in his debate with William Lane Craig. Now, I'm not going to play Craig's presentation because you've heard it. If you've ever heard William Lane Craig debating the subject of the resurrection of Christ, then you have already heard his presentation. I found Price's response very interesting, and I want you to listen in. Here is Robert Price responding to William Lane Craig on the subject of the resurrection of Jesus.
Price will have 20 minutes.
After what you just heard about me, you don't really want to clap, admit it. I'm going to save response to some of those specific points for the next little go-round, but read a prepared statement I came up with, and we'll see where it goes from here. Dr. Craig often appeals to the consensus of New Testament scholars on behalf of conservative views. By contrast, I am glad to confess that the opinion of the majority of scholars makes no difference whatever to me. In fact, in the Gospels, after all, it's a consensus of scholars in the Sanhedrin that condemns Jesus to death. As Francis Schaeffer used to say, you can't settle the question of truth by a majority vote. I think Martin Luther and Galileo and others knew that too. If I am interested in a question, I must examine the issues for myself. I reject, for example, Velikovsky's astronomy, not because the Academy sneers at it, which I guess they do, but because his methodology seems flawed to me as I understand it. And forgive me, but so does Dr. Craig's. First, let me call attention to two fundamental axioms of Dr. Craig's work. The first is what strikes me as a kind of double truth model. The second is the old red herring attempt to evade the principle of historical analogy by means of the claim that critics reject miracle stories only because they espouse philosophical naturalism. The second follows from the first, and both commit the fallacy of ad hominem argumentation even while projecting it onto the opponent. I think he tips his hand toward the end of the first chapter of his book, Reasonable Faith. He draws a distinction there between knowing Christianity is true and showing that it is true. He says, "What then should be our approach in apologetics? It should be something like this. My friend, I know Christianity is true because God's Spirit lives in me and assures me that it is true. And you can know it too because God is knocking at the door of your heart, telling you the same thing. If you are sincerely seeking God, then God will give you assurance that the gospel is true. Now, to show you it's true, I'll share with you some arguments and evidence that I really find convincing. But should my arguments seem weak and unconvincing to you, that's my fault, not God's. It only shows that I'm a poor apologist, not that the gospel is untrue. Whatever you think of my arguments, God still loves you and holds you accountable. I'll do my best to present good arguments to you, but ultimately you have to deal not with arguments, but with God himself," page 48. A little further on, he saith, "Unbelief is at the root a spiritual, not an intellectual problem. Sometimes an unbeliever will throw up an intellectual smokescreen so that he can avoid personal existential involvement with the gospel. Pages 49 to 50. Dr. Craig then freely admits his conviction arises from purely subjective factors. To me, it sounds no different in principle from the teenage Mormon door knocker. He tells you he knows the Book of Mormon was written by ancient Americans because he has a warm, swelling feeling inside when he asks God if it's true. Certain intellectual questions have to receive certain answers, then, to be consistent with this revivalistic, heartwarming experience. So Dr. Craig knows in advance that, for example, Strauss and Bultmann must have been wrong. And by hook or by crook, he'll find a way to get from here to there. His enterprise is circular since he grounds Christian belief upon a subjective state described already in Christian theological terminology, God's Spirit dwelling in his heart, etc. Dr. Craig seems to admit that he holds his faith on purely subjective grounds, but maintains that he's lucky to discover that the facts, objectively considered, happen to bear out his faith. Whereas theoretically, his faith might not prove true to the facts, in actuality, whew, it does. In any case, it's obvious from the same quotes that the arguments are ultimately beside the point. If an unbeliever doesn't see the cogency of Dr. Craig's brand of New Testament criticism, the same thing exactly as his apologetics, it can only be because the doubter has some guilty secret to hide and doesn't want to repent and let Jesus run his life. If one sincerely seeks God, Dr. Craig's arguments will mysteriously start looking pretty good to him. Dr. Craig's frank expression to his fellow evangelists and apologists is quite revealing. He tells you to say to the unbeliever that you find these arguments really convincing. But how can Dr. Craig simply take this for granted unless, as I'm sure he does, he knows he is writing to people for whom the cogency of the arguments is a foregone conclusion? They are arguments in behalf of a position his readers are already committed to as an a priori party line. His is a position that exalts voluntaristic decision above rational deliberation. Rational deliberation, though good, is by itself not good enough for the evangelist because it can never justify a quick decision such as Campus Crusade's booklet The Four Spiritual Laws solicits. Every one of Dr. Craig's scholarly articles on the resurrection implicitly ends with that little decision card for the reader to sign to invite Jesus into his heart as his personal savior. He's not trying to do disinterested historical or exegetical research. He's trying to get...
I don't know.
He doubts it. That he Jesus existed. Well,
I don't know what happened to it.
Folks
there
saved.
We go.
I know the feeling. I used to be the president of my InterVarsity chapter. Note how he characterizes people who do not accept his version of the historical Jesus as unbelievers, who merely cast up smoke screens of insincere carping. But this functions as a mirror image of his own enterprise. His apparently self-effacing pose, "If my arguments fail to convince, then I must have done a poor job of explaining them," just reveals the whole exercise to be a sham. The arguments are offered cynically, whatever it takes. If they don't work, take your pick between brimstone, God holds you accountable, and treacle, God still loves you. I'm not saying Dr. Craig is wittingly distorting the truth to win his point. Obviously he's not. But he is so committed to a dogmatic party line that he cannot see truth as meaning anything but that party line. Just as Kelly a moment ago said that truth ought to mean a person, not an abstract concept. In Dr. Craig's lexicon, you look up truth and it says, see gospel. To borrow Francis Schaeffer's terminology again, for the apologist, truth becomes merely a connotation word. Just as liberal theologian Albrecht Ritschl said, Jesus has the value of God for us. The apologist might say, Christianity has the value of truth for us. just as William James said that righteous endeavor was the moral equivalent of war, for apologists, Christianity is the moral equivalent of truth. Only it doesn't work. For Richelianism, Jesus was in fact not God. For William James, moral endeavor was not in fact war. Even so, anything that substitutes for the truth may be preferred to the truth, but then it's a fiction. If the charge that unbelievers are hiding behind a smokescreen is a mirror image of the apologist's own strategy, then the naturalistic presuppositions business is a specific instance of such childish, I know you are, but what am I tactics. Does it take a blanket presupposition for a historian to discount some miracle stories, like Elisha's axe head on the one extreme or the resurrection of Jesus on the other, as legendary? No, because as Bultmann recognized, there is no problem accepting reports even of extraordinary things that we can verify as still occurring today, like faith healings and exorcisms. However you may wish to account for them, you can go to certain meetings and see scenes resembling the Gospels. So it is by no means a matter of rejecting all miracle stories on principle. Biblical critics are not like Carl Sagan or James Randi, going into every investigation already convinced that the paranormal must be a fraud. No, they take miracle stories on a case-by-case basis. But such a selective, piecemeal and probabilistic acceptance of miracle stories is not what apologists want. They take umbrage that biblical critics do not wind up accepting any and all biblical miracles. So, if it would not require a blanket principle to reject the historicity of particular miracle stories, we must ask if it would take a blanket principle to require acceptance of all biblical miracles. Clearly it would, and that principle cannot be mere supernaturalism, that is, openness to the possibility that miracles can occur. One can believe God capable of anything without believing that he actually did everything anybody may say he did. One can believe in the possibility of miracles without believing that every reported miracle must have occurred. No, the requisite principle for accepting all biblical miracles is the principle of biblical inerrancy. The belief that all biblical narratives are historically accurate simply because they appear in the Bible. After all, it will not greatly upset Dr. Craig any more than it upset Warfield to deny the historical accuracy of medieval reports of miracles wrought by the Virgin Mary or the sacramental wafer, much less stories of miracles wrought by Gautama Buddha or Apollonius of Tyana. Supernaturalism is not at all the issue here. The issue is whether the historian is to abdicate his role as a sifter of evidence by accepting the dogma of inerrancy, even if clandestinely. I know Dr. Craig says he is sticking only to the elements of the gospel story accepted as historical by most scholars, but this is only tactical. He's shortening the apologetical line of defense. Once he has you in the fold, he'll press on to full inerrantism. Nor is naturalism the issue when the historian employs the principle of analogy. As F.H. Bradley showed in The Presuppositions of Critical History, no historical inference is possible unless the historian assumes a basic analogy of past experience with present experience. If we do not grant this, nothing will seem amiss in believing stories that A turned into a werewolf or B changed lead into gold. Hey, just because we don't see it happening today doesn't prove it never did. One could just as easily accept the historicity of Jack and the Beanstalk on the same basis as long as one's sole criterion for historical plausibility is anything goes. If there are ancient parallel legends about other saviors and sages rising from death or ascending into heaven, but there is no present-day instance, is the historian to be maligned as a narrow dogmatist or a moral coward refusing to repent if he judges the story of Jesus' resurrection as probably a legend too? The historical axiom of analogy does not dogmatize. Critical historians are not engaging in metaphysics and epistemology as if they could hop into a time machine and pontificate A didn't happen, B did. Again, Dr. Craig and his brethren are just... It is they and not critical historians who want to be able to point to sure results. Imagine a creed. If thou shalt confess with thy mouth the Lord Jesus and believe in thy heart that God hath probably raised him from the dead, thou shalt most likely be saved. Now, who's the joke on there? Historians don't have creeds. They frame hypotheses. Sure, you can find some hide-bound prof, some small-minded, insecure windbag who will not budge from a pet theory because he has too much personally invested in it. But you have no trouble recognizing such a person as a hack, a fake, a bad historian who ought to know better. Holocaust deniers, for example. The last thing you do is to emulate such behavior and make it into an operating principle. But apologists do. Again, it's projection. It reduces to this. At the end of the Four Spiritual Laws booklet, there's a cartoon diagram showing a toy locomotive engine labeled fact, pulling a coal car labeled faith, followed in turn by a superfluous caboose tagged feeling. The new convert is admonished to let faith rest on fact, not to allow faith to waver with feelings. But one must suspect that it is the caboose that is pulling the train and pulling it backward. Faith is based firmly on feeling, and certain notions are postulated as fact and defended as such because of the security they afford the sick soul who seeks a port in the existential storm. Dr. Craig has had occasion to cross swords with John Dominic Crossan. One need not agree with Crossan, I seldom do, to appreciate that he is, however, an innovative and creative New Testament scholar, that he marshals his vast learning in an attempt to find out new things from the Gospels. Crossan is concerned to advance the state of knowledge. Contrast him with Dr. Craig, who uses his own formidable erudition in one vast damage control operation. Every effort of Dr. Craig's is to squelch new theories that threaten to cast doubt on the traditional picture of the storybook Jesus. One feels that Dr. Craig would sooner put his efforts elsewhere than in putting out fires lit by Bultmann, Strauss, and Crossan. If he had his way, he'd be occupied with something more edifying. At least that's the feeling I get. Evangelicals think they've got the truth in their back pocket, so they can't be trying to find what they think they've already got. Novelty is the devil. They expend great time and efforts mastering the skills of Greek and Hebrew exegesis. Witness the unparalleled excellence of Dallas Theological Seminary in these areas. But for what? All their efforts at exegesis are the laborings of a mountain to bring forth a mouse. If one of them really comes up with something new theologically, it'll result in immediate charges of heresy. The effort is solely to hold the fort against the advance of intellectual history. Dr. Craig everywhere presupposes a pre-critical picture of the Gospels as straightforward records of reporting without tendential bias. He tries to make the Mark and empty tomb tale a piece of sober contemporary history. We're told that the story is unvarnished history since it betrays no signs of theological tendency. No theological coloring? In a story told to attest the resurrection of a Son of God from the dead? What else is it? Isn't it all varnish? For mica instead of wood? Charles Talbert, by the way, no God-hating atheist but a Southern Baptist, in his book, What is a Gospel?, has no trouble adducing abundant parallels from Hellenistic hero biographies in which the ascensions into heaven of Romulus, Aeneas, Hercules, Aristeas, Empedocles, Apollonius, etc. are inferred from the utter failure of their searching disciples to find any vestige of their bones, bodies, or clothing where they might be expected to be found. Sometimes they make a post-mortem appearance to their grieving and worshipful worshipful followers. These stories, like all ancient miracle tales, include the element of initial skepticism by the disciples, who were then convinced despite themselves. It's just a narrative device. None of them are factual reports. Talbert concludes that the empty tomb and resurrection stories in the Gospels would have been familiar genres to ancient readers, as of course they were. Pagan critics hastened to point out the similarities, and Christian apologists lamely countered that Satan had counterfeited the gospel episodes in advance to throw unbelievers off the track. Excuse me. Contra Dr. Craig, the empty tomb story is theological through and through. If we're truly interested in history, how can we dismiss other ancient vanished body and post-mortem appearance stories, making an exception in the single case of Jesus who just happens to be the founder of our religion? And once we recognize the gospel resurrection narratives to be cut from the same cloth, all questions of whether the women went to the wrong tomb or if the disciples stole the body or rented it or whatever, or whether the Sanhedrin could have produced it with dental records to prove who it was, or whether the disciples saw a hallucination or a case of mistaken identity, it's all seemed to be moot.
Okay, so there was Price's opening statement, and that was, okay. Want to play another one for you, and I know someone's going to be calling in. Hold that off a second. We'll try to get something toward the end, but I want to get these in today, and sometimes when we get calls in and I'm trying to do something else, it ends up being very disjointed, which doesn't help anybody else out a lot. At the end of this debate, they decide to let everybody pose a bunch of questions to each speaker. As I'm going to play all the questions that are posed to Bob Price, I just want you to listen to how he responds.
Idea.
Okay. So, let's see, where did we leave off there? Okay. Could you all state your questions as briefly as you can? And if your question has then already been asked, maybe step out of line.
My question is kind of a... carries over from the previous question, and it's directed at Dr. Price. I actually was going to ask you about the extra biblical sources in terms of seeking a belief in a historical Christ, and I was going to ask you about Josephus as well as Cornelius Tacitus, who makes a clear reference to the execution of Christ in his work. What? How do you feel about the historicity of Christ as a person and the historicity of his death in light not just of what we've talked about tonight in the Bible, but the extra-biblical sources?
Great. And then the next question?
Dr. Price, Dr. Craig made several corrections to the statements that you made. First one being that we do have the 200 AD document of 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Second being that one of the church fathers, Ignatius, did mention verses 8 and 9 of the 1 Corinthians 15. And third being that you used one of the passages from mythology as a proof, presupposing that it was predating the gospel accounts. Yet, Dr. Craig showed that that passage was written in response to Christian documents. And you had several occasions where you could have responded to those, and you didn't. And if we do find out tonight that those are mistakes in your research, what reasons do we have to believe that anything else that you've said tonight, in all due respect, carries any value or significance? Thanks.
Thanks. Next.
My question has to do with what Dr. Craig spoke on in his opening argument. It's directed towards Dr. Price, though. He gave four reasons why he believed that the resurrection of Jesus Christ was reasonable, the honorable burial, empty tomb, post-mortem appearances, and the change in the disciples' faith. Do you believe that any of these are true? If you do, why? If you don't, why?
Dr. Price, if indeed faith is less than legitimate or valid because it is based perhaps on subjective feelings, as you said at the beginning. And if indeed those feelings are less than valid and legitimate in themselves, what is it that you base your mentions of sin, dishonesty, and your zealous drive to seek the truth.
Thank you.
Yeah, it seemed that the argument or the question at the beginning of the evening was, did Jesus Christ rise from the dead? Dr. Craig clearly tried to present a case, yes, Jesus rose from the dead. He gave at least four lines of evidence. I didn't hear the refutation of them. It seems that you would argue, no, Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead. But what I heard was, maybe, I don't think so, but probably not. Mm-hmm. And my question is, what convinces you, if in fact you're convinced he did not rise from the dead, what's the line of evidence that you gave that would convince us that Jesus did not rise from the dead? And what is the refutation for the four main lines of evidence that he presented clearly, and you had 45 minutes to respond to, and didn't make your case?
Thank you.
My question concerns your parallel between Apollonius and the story of Doubting Thomas. And you say there are a number of parallels, but aren't there a number of really stark differences? For instance, Thomas did not expect to see Jesus, whereas Apollonius' disciple seemed to expect that. And the Apollonius' disciple saw a vision, whereas Thomas was in the presence of disciples who saw a physical body appear to him, the physical body of Jesus.
When you were speaking of the fact that the women that were witnesses to the empty, open tomb, and the fact that they would have been accepted in that culture, even if the culture that they had come from was a pagan society and had been more open to women's opinions, the opinions that the woman had given were second-guessed by all of the men in these situations, not only with the tomb in Luke chapter 4, but also in John chapter 23, when the woman at the well, Jesus foretells all of her life to her, and then she goes and tells her city or town as Jesus asks her to, and the men have to come back and double check and make sure that what she's saying is true. These women were not accepted as true witnesses, despite the fact that this culture, I mean, even if it was a pagan society, they still double-checked the women. And also, in reading the book's Acts of Jesus, I was just wondering, since you stated that you doubt the historicity of any literary document, did you vote for all black, or, you know, did you overstep the bounds of colors in the choices of anything being historically accurate, since you did not pose Josephus or anybody else as also historically acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Price, during your 8-minute counter rebuttal, you made a statement referring to Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 through 11, where Jesus of Nazareth is referred to exalted as being exalted. Something that crossed my mind that I'd be interested to hear your take on was how could a shamefully crucified leader of a very small minority possibly be referred to as exalted if he were still dead, unless he had resurrected?
I was just curious, Dr. Price, with your disinclination to believe in the resurrection, upon what authority you lead your home group. That's all.
I'm sorry, on what authority?
Upon what authority do you lead your home group when you have a disinclination to believe in the resurrection?
On what authority do I lead that home group?
When there's a disinclination, yes. Uh-huh. You have a church or a group in your home, you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay.
Last question.
Mr. Price, in all of your arguments that I've heard this evening, you've pretty much discounted a lot of New Testament authority people. Being a New Testament authority yourself, and you're asking us to believe that we have to accept and consider all possibilities, what if you're wrong? And he's right. What then?
Okay. I think I can actually cram these in. Let's see. For one thing, a few of them real quick. All excellent questions. If I am wrong, what I think somebody asked Clarence Darrow this. He was much interested in religion, but an agnostic. And they said, "What if you know, the old Christian thing is right, and you get to the pearly gates and find out?" He said, "Well, I'd say, gentlemen, I was mistaken."
And you have to ask then, well, is God going to be a peevish theology professor that says, that's too bad, you bastard, you're going to fry. If that is the reaction of God, I don't think that's a God worthy of worship, so I'm not too worried. I think if I seek the truth as well as I can, with as clean a conscience as I can, I'm not going to worry. I mean, I'm going to hell in somebody's dogma anyway, right? The Muslims, the Jehovah's Witnesses, I might as well call them as I see them. My authority in preaching is not an authority. I take the approach, I understand Socrates to have taken the midwife approach. I pose questions and perspectives, and I seek to get people to think about them, and I speak for about 20 minutes and then have a couple of hours of discussion with my tiny little group where all viewpoints are heard. So I do not seek or claim an authority to tell somebody a truth that they must accept because I say it. I did vote all black on historical issues in the Gospels at the Jesus Seminar as to how a slain Jewish leader could be thought to be exalted up to the right hand of God without a resurrection. Well, in 2 Maccabees, we're told that Judah Maccabee had a vision of Onias III, the priest slain by the agents of Antiochus Epiphanes, and that for his righteousness he had been exalted to serve as a mediator before the throne of God in heaven along with Jeremiah for his people. They didn't believe Onias had been resurrected. And it seems to me many early Christians may have believed the same thing about Jesus before they adopted the belief that he had already been resurrected. Just as many of Rabbi Schneerson's followers today think he will be resurrected, and some are beginning to think that perhaps he has. Women as witnesses. My point was not that, yes, they were recognized as witnesses after all, though I have heard some researchers say that there may be some basis to say that. I'm not competent to judge. My point is simply that the empty tomb stories come from a different quarter. They're not offered as evidence for the resurrection. They're deposits, rather, of a kind of women's lamentation literature, such as is mentioned by Ezekiel, the women who mourned for the dying and rising God in Jerusalem. So they're not offered as proof of anything. The doubting Thomas thing in Apollonius of Tyana, it strikes me that if you understand what an ideal type is in any field of study, it's a kind of a broad dictionary definition that gathers the similarities that one usually finds in particular examples. You find a textbook picture of a human being as opposed to an ape. You're not going to find any human that looks exactly like that. But if you see two or three people together with a head, two legs, two arms, one of them has red hair, one of them has black hair, is that human beings? They're nothing alike. You have to, I mean, the whole thing assumes that there are differences. The point is, it seems to me the similarities are quite striking. If this disciple had a vision in a waking dream of Apollonius, it seems to me just a variation on the acceptable range of variants for one where they think they're seeing a vision of Jesus, but he's really there. There's another Apollonius story where they think he's raised from the dead because he appears in a locked room, but he isn't. He's just teleported like Philip does from Ethiopia to Azotus or whatever it is in the book of Acts. So it seems to me that one seizes on the irrelevant differences to avoid the force of the similarities. Speaking of Apollonius, I do not recall this business that Philostratus was commissioned to write a counterblast to the Gospels. I don't think even Eusebius says that in his rejoinder to the life of Apollonius by Philostratus. What I do remember is that the empress asked him to, or commissioned him to write the thing to rehabilitate his reputation because Apollonius was widely considered to be a wizard and a sorcerer, just as Jesus was among pagans who didn't believe in him. And so he wrote this life of a philosopher as an apologetic, but I don't know that there's any reason to think it was a counterblast to Christianity. The date of 1 Corinthians 15, 8 and 9, I'm not trying to say that this was interpolated in the 5th century or something. I'm trying to say that it's after the time of Paul. You got several decades before anybody quotes it or any manuscripts are found. It doesn't require a huge amount of time for that, so I don't have a problem with that. The extra-biblical references and so on, I tend to
agree with Dr. Craig that given what, well, that there, you do have to take seriously the New Testament evidence. I just find it to be wanting historically when I do. But I do not think that that it's some shocking thing to find little to nothing in ex-biblical sources, because if the Gospels are true in every respect historically, what would your pagan newspaper editor, so to speak, have known? Who would have said, oh, there's another faith healer, an exorcist, or there are a dime a dozen. You wouldn't expect to find much about Jesus, so that has never struck me as a powerful argument. Tacitus does refer to the execution of Christus under the prefect of Pontius Pilate. That, I don't think, is really important evidence, because it simply reflects what everyone knew Christians believe. It's interesting he calls him Jesus, not Jesus, but Christus. It implies he simply heard Christian preaching. So, and same thing with the Pliny, the Younger letter to Trajan. Yeah, we knew Christians believed in Christ. That's no big deal. The Josephus thing has been rewritten to some degree, but no one knows how much, because there are different versions of it in Arabic, Slavonic, and Greek. And apparently some of it has been added since Origen read a copy of it in the second century that we don't have. But I think it is likely Josephus did refer to Jesus. And that would be evidence on the scale of a historical Jesus. I'm not trying to say it's all or nothing. It just seems to me, on balance, that the predominantly legendary cast of the Jesus material outweighs the other. But it's not absolutely clear. I, of course, admit I could be wrong. In fact, I'm not making a dogmatic assertion on any question. My point is that I'm trying to approach it in terms of historical methodology. I'm not trying to make dogmatic theological statements. And therefore, what I base my urge to intellectual honesty on and so forth, it's simply a matter of consistency. I don't know that one can prove there's an absolute categorical imperative written in stone that one ought to value love, truth, etc. It just seems to me those are good things to value, and as long as we can agree on that, the truth is good, I feel comfortable urging everyone to intellectual honesty. I couldn't prove to some Nazi that it's not a good idea to tell the truth and to love people, but I think we all agree on that. Let's see, about these points that I've allegedly neglected, I've tried to say again and again, there is no fact there's no fact necessitated by the story that a man named Joseph saw to the burial of Jesus. I mean, it's stated in a narrative source which seems everywhere else to be filled with marvels and so forth, or historical difficulties and anachronisms. There are various problems with it. It just seems to me that, sure, a man named Joseph of Arimathea could have buried Jesus, but there's no particular reason to think so because of the quality of the source. The same thing with the empty tomb thing. If it's to be seen as one more apotheosis story where the clue is no one can find the body, you just don't have to raise the questions of, yeah, what did they do with the body? It's a myth. But let's assume that since nobody seems to want to hear that, let's assume there really was a burial of Jesus, and that they did not produce the body to expose the hoax. Well, look, what does the book of Acts say? They waited 7 weeks after the death of Jesus to proclaim the resurrection. A rotting pile of flesh by dental records? Hey, it's Jesus! Take a whiff! You know, that's impossible. It's ridiculous. And as for the rabbi saying, oh, he stole the body. Well, in a third century source, a rabbi says, you say he rose from the dead? Oh, okay, he rose from the dead. Satan raised him, though. You see, the style of argumentation is to say, I'll go you one better. The tomb was empty? Great. But that's just because they stole the body. It doesn't presuppose that they knew what had happened or didn't happen. It's just tit-for-tat polemics. So I don't think you have to take the empty tomb thing too seriously. The appearances, people have visions of Jesus all the time, as I admit. It just seems to me that these things are deposits of redactional and legendary material, so that I do not see the gospel texts as good evidence for appearances that someone had. Maybe they did see the risen Jesus. Maybe Oral Roberts saw him. I don't have any. It's just that it doesn't have much veridical value. And finally, what could have transformed them? Again, we do not know that, and Josephus tells us about the martyrdom of James, doesn't ever mention the resurrection of Jesus. He says, why do you ask me concerning the Son of Man? And they split his skull open. Unfortunately, he doesn't say, why do you ask me concerning the death and resurrection on the third day? We don't know that that was on the agenda. And many scholars think that there was early non-resurrection, even non-messianic belief in Jesus. Now, let's assume that there were disciples who followed Jesus and were grossly disappointed and taken aback and disillusioned when he died. Can we explain the ongoing of the movement? Of course we can. Look at the Seventh-day Adventists, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the movement of Sabbatai Zvi, and countless other movements that have had gross disappointments. In the case of the Sabbatian movement in the 17th century, the Messiah apostatized. He was put on the spot. You will be executed or adopt Islam. What was his reaction? Allahu Akbar. I mean, if you think the crucifixion of the Messiah is bad, how about the apostasy of the Messiah? Did the movement collapse? No. They suddenly said, oh, well, he didn't really apostatize. It was just a phantom. Or he did, but it was an atoning apostasy so that he could plumb the depths of sin for us so that we wouldn't have to. And it was prophesied, too. Do we forget to tell you that? And so on and so forth. It's the same kind of desperate cognitive dissonance reduction strategy. Many people will fall away, like the two guys going back to Emmaus. That's psychologically plausible. Well, we hoped he was the Messiah. But many others will say, hey, no way. I'm not going to face that ridicule. Come hell or high water, he was the Messiah. I went to Berkeley once and saw, in about 1979, a table set up on the campus for Guru Maharaji. And I said, hey, wait a second. Didn't this kid's mom kick him off the throne of the universe for marrying his secretary? Don't they know that? And my friend said, they just think it's a media hoax. The Rastafarians, they believe Haile Selassie's still alive. We know he isn't, but they say it's a media hoax. There were people that wanted Jim and Tammy Baker back. There were people that didn't want Clinton impeached. I mean, whatever you say, whatever you prove, some people are not going to budge. And so it seems to me it's naive to even seek some big mysterious explanation. And one last thing, to invoke a miracle as an explanation, that's trying to explain X by double X. You know, we don't understand what happened here, so let's say a miracle did it. Yeah. That's like saying we don't know who built the pyramid, so it must have been UFOs. Oh, well, thanks. We got that one settled. You know, well, anyway, enough of that.
So. Thanks, Dr. Price.
Well, there you go. And everybody's sitting there, why aren't you interacting with him? I'm going to be in May, okay? The point was to demonstrate that here was this long line of questions, way too many questions. But he pretty much kept track of all of them and responded to each one. And what you're listening to is the ultimate example of skepticism. There is not an argument that Robert Price has not encountered that he cannot be skeptical about, that he cannot say, well, we don't know. Now, when you listen, actually, if you listen carefully to his lectures and things, he's always saying, we know. He uses terms like absurdity and absolute certainty terms in knowing that we can't believe what Christianity says, but we just don't know. And so how do you respond to that? That's my task over the next little over a month to respond to that kind of a presentation, and hopefully to do so in such a way that is edifying to the saints and so on and so forth. So I covet your prayers in that preparation, but just to let you know the kind of presentation that we're going to be encountering when we debate Robert Price. And I think in some ways that's going to be a little bit more representative of the kind of stuff that you hear on university campuses and things like that than your standard Bart Ehrman presentation. Frequently it's a mixture because people don't realize there's differences and things like that. But that's why I wanted to present that information to you. And so you can listen. He's called the Bible Geek. He certainly does have an encyclopedic knowledge of ancient world history and issues that Sabbatai Zvi, who in the world is that? Well, I've had to find out because it's the kind of stuff that he presents. And so it's going to be quite the challenge. And if you're in the Florida area, you might want to be there to attend. All right, let's. We don't have a whole lot of time left in the program today. We can go a little bit long. We lost him. Okay. We had a caller from Saudi Arabia. I believe it was Bassam Zawadi. Had called in, taking exception to my very brief article yesterday, where I, well, it's called Theology Matters Again. What happens when a monotheistic religion that rejects revelation of God in Christ and, two, lacks the heart-changing power of the gospel gains power over culture? History gives us many examples. Today you can read about the atrocities of such combinations of false religion and political power on a daily basis, especially coming from the Islamic world. Here are two recent ones that illustrate the point. I've just been seeing so many stories. In fact, I'm starting to wonder if it isn't unwise of me to have so many feeds where I see this every single day. Some of you saw the Christians being beaten to death in the streets in India. Now, I don't know if those were Hindus or Muslims that were doing that. I don't know. But some of you saw that video. One of the first video I ever saw online was Muslims in Indonesia beating a man to death and then slicing his throat. That was the first video I ever saw online many, many years ago, a Christian martyr dying in that way. And my point in raising the issue was not that there are not, and I've made this point before, there are quote-unquote moderate Muslims who would argue against this. In fact, in the famous text that is always raised by Ergun Kanner, but he never gives a specific reference. It's in Sahih al-Bukhari 957. Some atheists were brought to Ali, and he burnt them. The news of this event reached Ibn Abbas, who said, "If I had been in his place, I would not have burnt them, as Allah's apostle forbade it, saying, 'Do not punish anybody with Allah's punishment,' which was fire. I would have killed them, according to the statement of Allah's apostle. Whoever changed his Islamic religion, then kill him." Now, it's interesting, there's no discussion provided here as to whether these were atheists who had once been Muslims. And the problem here, and I again wish my moderate Muslim friends all the best here, but the argument that is made by Al-Qaeda and others, the Taliban, etc., is that no one is not a kafir and is not an apostate because we're all born as Muslims. We all took the oath when Allah rubs Adam's back and all of mankind stands on the great plain. We all took that oath, and therefore, if we believe anything other than Islam, then we are apostates. That's their argument. Now, argue against it. Please, go ahead, do so. But the problem is the guy sitting over next to the window believes what he's heard. The window of the plane, you know, with the underpants on. And that's the problem. And they're the underpants that go boom. That is not. I'm hoping that everyone's wearing underpants, but the underpants that go boom are the real problem. that's where the issue arises. And I just simply point out one thing: where you have allegedly Christian cultures, and I don't know where there are any today, to be perfectly honest with you. But I could never debate this subject where Bassam Zawadi is. That is in Saudi Arabia, because we couldn't debate in Mecca. I'm not allowed to go there. And we all know that if I were to say the things that I would need to say as a Christian, defending what Christians believe in light of, for example, Surah 112, Ayah 3, where God begetteth not, nor is he begotten. If I were to have to give the Christian response to that in those lands, I would be subject to all sorts of legal penalties. I certainly would be in grave danger in Pakistan today, where these types of atrocities are taking place. That's my point, that theology matters, because Christianity changes the hearts of man, and Islam does not have the power to change the heart of man. That is the difference. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back, Lord willing, on Thursday here on The Dividing Line. We'll talk to you then. God bless. Noise.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.